If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey everyone, Seth Meyers here. Tomorrow is Election Day, and today we have one last pre-election edition of our special podcast series, Midterm Cram. Late night staffers Sal Gentile and Henry Melcher today talk to Arielle Edwards-Levy, reporter and polling editor for HuffPost. They discuss the final days of the campaigns across the country before we finally head for the polls tomorrow. And speaking of election night, late night, we'll have a special live episode on election night. So to be sure to check that out on NBC. Hope you enjoy Henry and Sal's discussion with Arielle. And if you haven't already, make sure you vote tomorrow.
Hey, Sal.
Hey, Henry.
This is our last midterm cram before the midterms. We are recording this Friday, so we are currently a few days out from the election.
Yeah, this is it. We're in the home stretch.
Home stretch. We made it.
Yeah. Well, not yet.
That's true.
Yeah. We might not make it.
We might not make it.
We'll find out.
Yeah.
And it's been a pretty bewildering home stretch. It's been pretty insane. For example, today's Friday. Mm-hmm. The jobs report came out today. And just to give you an idea of where things are politically in the country right now and what the closing messages are, the macroeconomic picture is pretty good.
Yeah. Unemployment dropped down to 3.7%. I think 250,000 jobs were added last month.
Yeah. And you would expect in a normal political environment for the party that's in power to run on that.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, with a good macroeconomic picture, Republicans are still furiously throwing as much crazy against the wall as they possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives you an idea of the political position they're in. I mean, the jobs numbers are good, and yet Donald Trump just made up a fictional tax cut that he said he was going to pass before the midterms.
Congress is not in session.
While Congress is not even in session.
Mm-hmm.
Republicans are furiously trying to convince people that they are now in favor of Obamacare,
mm-hmm.
despite almost all of them to a person either voting to repeal Obamacare or promising to repeal Obamacare. And Trump is sending 15,000 troops to the border in a racist gambit to scare people about a migrant caravan that is still very far away and is just mostly vulnerable people fleeing poverty and violence. So consider that that is what they're doing, even when the economy is very good.
Yeah.
And that gives you an idea of the political position that they're in right now.
And it seems like their just political strategy here is, I mean, as if Trump has some grand political strategy, is to gin up fear, make people really scared, and just pull out the base where that message will work. Meanwhile, Democrats, as we talked to Sarah Cliff about last week, are running on healthcare.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to see Democrats are closing on policy and not backing down on their positions on healthcare. They're running strong on healthcare, which is kind of a bewildering thing to see on that end, too. Democrats are running hard on Obamacare, and Republicans are running on these kind of culture wars. And there's an interesting piece in the New York Times a couple days ago about how, you know, Trump doing these rallies, throwing out this red meat, talking about the caravan, is actually starting to turn off a lot of moderate Republicans. And the party is kind of fearing that this is all going to backfire, that really focusing on the base, people who may have already been really excited to vote, is not the best strategy. You're losing people that could kind of go either way.
Yeah. And think about how revealing that is. Republicans are the party in power. They should have a record to run on from the past 2 years. Instead, it's the Democrats, who have had absolutely no power in Washington over the past 2 years, who are running on substantive accomplishments from before when they were in power.
Yeah.
They're running on a law that they passed, and Republicans, instead of running on the things that they have done, are, as you said, just ginning up racist incitement to scare as many people as they possibly can. There are things that they could, if they wanted to, talk about, like For example, the corporate tax cut that they gave.
The signature.
Yeah, the signature achievement of their last 2 years in office. Mm-hmm. But they're not running on that, obviously.
Democrats are running on it.
Yeah, Democrats are running on repealing it. And
Democrats
trying to,
are running on Republicans' biggest accomplishment.
Yes. It's just so deeply revealing about what the Republican Party has become in the political position that they're in right now. And this theme of Democrats running on substantive policy is very interesting in a couple states. For example, Wisconsin is a fascinating state to look at right now. Tammy Baldwin is running for re-election there on a very substantive progressive agenda. She's embraced Medicare for All, for example.
She was one of the most threatened Democrats.
Yeah.
More money, I think, was going into her state than almost any other state. More outside money, rather.
She's fending off like tons of like Coke money and special interest money. The Koch brothers, not actual cocaine
money.
Yeah, yeah. The drug cartels are pouring in money to try to take her down. Yeah. Money from the Koch brothers. And she's got like a pretty significant polling advantage
now. That race has been particularly interesting. Senator Baldwin's here a few months ago, and this really was one of the most at-risk seats for Democrats. And suddenly she's just kind of pulling away. The governor's race in Wisconsin's much closer.
Yeah, it's much closer, but it's also incredibly revealing as well. Scott Walker, the signature thing of his very brief presidential run was that he was going to repeal Obamacare in its entirety.
Yes.
And he made that very clear. These guys, like Ted Cruz, when he was running, he famously said he will repeal every single word of Obamacare. They didn't.
And famously said, I like green eggs and ham.
Yes, he also said he would. Yeah.
I like them, Sam I am.
Yes, right. And now he's backpedaling on that. He's like, I hate green eggs, and Dr. Seuss is an idiot. Anyone can rhyme words together. These guys they weren't mealy mouthed when they talked about Obamacare. They made it very clear what their position is. Now, Scott Walker, the other day, he said that he would use the exact language that is in Obamacare. He would codify the exact language, word for word, on pre existing conditions in Wisconsin law if he's reelected. I mean, the turnaround is just stunning. These guys are just shameless liars. Like, they're
shameless.
It's obvious, I know, but the degree to which they have to lie about their record is so deeply revealing.
Because the politics on this have changed.
Yeah.
Which is also really interesting. Obamacare did not poll well. I mean, it still, in a large sense, does not poll extremely well, but something like pre-existing conditions, which is part and parcel of Obamacare, does poll really well, and now Democrats are running strongly on that. It's really amazing to see.
Yeah, and we talked about this a little bit last week with Sarah Cliff.
Yeah.
It's the degree to which the proposition that Democrats made when they passed Obamacare has finally come to fruition. It took a long time, but when you extend social insurance to people, they come to depend on it and like it, and they don't want you to take it away.
Of course.
And even Republicans are admitting that it's hurting them. In Arizona, Martha McSally, congresswoman who voted to repeal Obamacare, told Sean Hannity this week on a radio interview, she said, I'm getting my ass kicked on healthcare.
Yeah, they know.
Yeah, they know.
It's
and
very
it's actually
clear.
It's actually amazing the degree to which, like, in their brief moments of honesty, they admit the reality of what is happening, which is what they took a really shitty vote to hurt a lot of people that is deeply unpopular, and it's killing them right now. And the only way around it is to just lie through their teeth.
In Nevada, Jackie Rosen is running against sitting Senator Dean Heller, who also voted to repeal Obamacare, and her campaign has been, in many ways, laser focused on his vote to repeal Obamacare.
Yeah.
Healthcare, again, just continues to be the defining issue right now, it seems, in these final days.
Yeah. So we're going to find out in the next few days which of these strategies is effective or not. It seems right now like the Republican strategy is not effective, the Democrats is. We're going to find out if that's the case on Tuesday. We're also going to find out if Trump manages to pass a middle class tax cut without Congress in session.
It's currently scheduled for Sunday morning.
Yeah.
But it's just going to be him
in Central Park.
In Central Park.
Yeah.
On his ice rink.
Yes.
With Mike Pence.
And the Mandarin Duck. And they're going to be.
Google that. If,
Google the Mandarin
that's
Duck.
That's a great story.
Yeah. Oh, I love the Mandarin Duck.
So on this episode, we talked to Ariel Edwards Levy about the duck.
Yeah, mostly about the duck.
Mostly about the duck.
How the duck is polling.
How the duck is polling. The change in the support of the duck.
Yes.
It's actually not so far off from what we did talk to her about. She is a polling expert from Huffington Post. We talked about the state of polls, how polling works.
Yeah.
And then we talked a lot about this kind of like genius predictive octopus.
Yeah.
That apparently has passed away, but we learned about...
Well, you spoiled it, unfortunately. He has passed away.
Oh.
It's a spoiler. I'm sorry to ruin the story
just
for
no
you guys.
Going
there's
in.
A whole emotional arc.
You're
going
to hear about this really
brace
extraordinary
yourselves.
Octopus.
The genius octopus.
Yeah, that is smarter...
I like, by the way, that Ariel actually called him a psychic octopus, but you called him a genius octopus. It's not that he's psychic. He's just really smart.
He gets... Yeah. His predictions are right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's this genius octopus. We'll talk about that.
There may be more of them out there, too, which we learn.
Yeah. There might be more genius octopuses.
Octopi.
Octopi. That's right.
Is that right?
I actually don't know.
It's... I think it actually...
You know who would know the answer to this? A genius octopus. if you're scarred about thinking about polling from 2016, this will be a very good conversation to listen to.
Yeah, we Skyped with Ariel from DC, and here's that conversation now. We are here with Ariel Edwards-Levy, political reporter and polling editor at the Huffington Post. Ariel, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I wanted to start with this question. I've told some people that you were going to be on our show this Friday and we were going to talk to you about polling. And there were so many people who were like, well, you can't trust the polls. I mean, polls are ridiculous. There's no reason to believe any. I mean, look at 2016. All the polls are wrong. So I'm wondering, as a polling expert, can you defend polling?
I can indeed.
Great.
I think one of the things that has been really notable to me is that the people who seem to have sort of the most faith and the highest expectations for polls are also the people who are now saying that they can't trust them. And it's because they're expecting them to be infallible. And nobody who does this for a living or who spends a lot of time thinking seriously about this expects polling to be infallible. Mm-hmm. You will hear pollsters say, almost to the point of exhaustion, they're snapshots. They're not predictions. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the biggest lessons that I certainly took from 2016, and I think a lot of people did, was that we need to be very careful with ourselves in terms of measuring uncertainty and much better about how we communicate that with the public. But so that's one of the first things. Polls will tell you a general sense of what a race looks like. They're a snapshot. They're not a prediction. They're not always going to get it right on the mark. There's a lot of ways that things can err. The other thing is that, you know, national polling was not very far off. It was actually not further off than in a typical election. Mm-hmm. So what you had were a couple of states where the polling missed for a couple of reasons. We know some of them. We know that education was an issue that I can get into a long thing about methodology there that will probably bore the life out of people. We also know that there was probably a fairly dramatic late swing toward Trump in some of those states that didn't get measured. And we know that the popular vote didn't line up with the Electoral College. So all of those things contributed. Right. So, you know, I think polling tells you a lot about the race. And also sometimes what polls tell you is you're not going to know the answer.
Yeah.
That said, I would like polls to be predictive and tell me everything that's going to happen so that I don't have to worry about it and not have anxiety.
Yeah. We said we weren't going to do this, but let's just go through the races.
Well,
California District 1.
Yeah, please. But in reality, it feels impossible whenever you try to keep up on polling right now to get a sense of what's actually happening. It feels that way to me. And maybe that's because pollsters are trying to do a much better job of educating people about the uncertainty inherent in polling. So maybe that there are so many caveats every time I see something about sort of the broader national picture looks like right now that I feel like for a lot of people, it might be hard to get a grasp on it. So if it's at all possible, I know we're asking you to do something that is don't make predictions, but just give us you mentioned it's a snapshot, not a prediction. What is the snapshot telling us right now?
So to complicate that analogy even further, what it actually is a lot of snapshots, some of which are, you know, a little bit blurrier than others, or you have somebody photobombing in the background, or a variety of things. And I think sometimes the picture is not entirely clear. I mean, if you look at what happened with the Kavanaugh nomination, there were people making good faith arguments afterwards that this had basically increased Republican enthusiasm, increased Democratic enthusiasm, increased both. And I think you could point to a lot of things. And the other issue is that you're trying to get sort of a national picture of something that's happening in many cases at a real district level where there are, you know, individual candidates who are going door to door and there are very different pictures place to place. All that being said, I think there are some things you can say about the national picture. One is that this election is much more motivating than, say, the 2014 midterms. You know, pretty much every metric that you look at, enthusiasm is a lot higher. And that's, you know, Democrats are traditionally lagging a lot in terms of enthusiasm on midterms. Traditionally, the demographics that vote Democratic are a little bit less likely to turn out. This time, I think you're seeing people really tuned into that. So that's one thing I can say. The other thing, you know, the economic picture is pretty decent. That is helpful to the Republican Party. President Trump is not especially popular, although he's not in the worst place he's been right now. So, you know, that's probably not helpful for the Republican Party, although not as bad as it might have been, say, a year ago.
Let's talk about Trump's polling for a second before we get into some of the more specific granularities of the national picture.
What a tease for things to come. Granularities.
We will be getting into all types of granularities later.
Stick around for the granularities.
There's an interesting thing with Trump, and I'd like you to explain it, which is basically that the more Trump does and the more that people are aware of him, the worse his polling is and the worse that that is for the Republican Party. And it feels like lately we've seen a lot more of Trump. And I'm wondering if that means that his polling has been worse and that it's had a negative effect on the Republicans' fortunes.
Yeah, it's very interesting because I think that it's not always intuitive. You know, people say, oh, he's out there. He's, motivating the base. And, you know, I think that's true. I think he probably is motivating his base. Even his base, in some polling we've done, we've looked at how people respond to his tweets. Even Republicans prefer sort of more typical Republican politician tweets rather than the president of the United States calling somebody a horse face on Twitter. You know, and the other thing is that the percentage of people who really like President Trump is always going to be a little bit smaller, you know, than the people who really, really dislike President Trump. So all of that is sort of reasons that Republicans might have hoped that he would go on a relaxing vacation, you know, the couple of weeks before the election. The other thing to keep in mind is that President Trump's approval ratings, one of the really interesting things about it is how tightly constrained his approval ratings have been. They've been in this very narrow band.
I want to step back for a second from Trump and the midterms and ask you another question about the larger picture of polling. This is something you hear a lot from people who kind of distrust or poor position to maybe distrust polls, is that they've never been polled. They don't know anyone that's been polled. I personally haven't been polled. I don't know anyone that's been polled. I'm wondering if you hear that a lot, and can you explain who typically gets polled and how they are polled? Is it always landline? Is it cell phone? Is it a mixture? Is it changing?
Okay, so that is a question that I could go into a thesis on, and I will try not to do that.
We've arrived at the granularities.
We're here.
So polling has really evolved very quickly over, you know, even the last couple of election cycles is the answer to that. You know, there was sort of a golden age period a couple decades ago when polling was conducted basically with landline phones, and everybody had a landline phone, and people generally answered their landline phones. And so you got a pretty decent response. Right. People would pick it up, their phone, they would talk to the pollsters, they would hang up, you know, poll completed. Mm-hmm. Now, what happened after that was A, cell phones came on the market, B, telemarketing became a bigger thing, and C, in response to that, caller ID became a bigger thing. And suddenly response rates to those phone calls just start dropping and dropping and dropping. And that sort of defined a lot of what was happening, you know, about a decade ago. Now, almost not every pollster, but the vast majority of pollsters who you're seeing from media companies, from universities, things like that, they will be calling cell phones. Almost everybody is, because the, you know, so many people are living in cell phone only households. They're different from the people who don't live in those households, and you need to talk to them. So basically, people are calling cell phones now. There's also a lot of surveys being done online. YouGov, who we work with at HuffPost, use an online panel. There are other methods of doing online surveys. For instance, you know, SurveyMonkey, you may have taken a SurveyMonkey survey where people were trying to figure out the best day for a party or what you wanted to have for dinner for, you know, an office thing. And then they'll sort of funnel you into taking a couple of political surveys while you're at it.
Oh, wait, really?
That's crazy.
Yeah, what?
That's another... model right there. In terms of,
I was just
going,
doing
okay,
a BuzzFeed quiz, yeah, to figure out what character I am in Harry Potter, and suddenly, yeah, I'm like, yeah, I'm,
I found out
Brand,
that I'm a Carrie, and then
and you're voting
out
for Gillibrand.
Yeah, yeah, there's no way so, that can be totally accurate. I can't believe people get essentially tricked into taking a political, yeah, poll.
Okay, BuzzFeed polls are not the same thing. I will put that out there. Here's another important point. Besides how surveys reach you, is also how do surveys know who you are? How are they picking, yeah, these numbers? And there are a couple ways. If for the people who are calling you on the phone, some of them are randomly calling phone numbers. They generate a list of numbers. They call them. Another thing is that you can look at voter files, which despite the name, it's based primarily on people who've registered to vote and all the information you provide, which is public, not, you know, who you voted for, but your name, in some cases, your party registration, what your voting history is. And a lot of commercial vendors will add other information to that. So a lot of people are using those lists to start calling people up. And then obviously you have things like online panels and all of those things. The key is that you need to know who's responding to your poll and how they compare to the, you know, American public as a whole to get sort of a sense of, making sure that you're actually talking to people who represent the people who don't get polled.
The history of polling responses is also very funny to me, because there was a time, obviously very early in the age of polling, if I'm correct, that like most people would answer polls. And now it's like their polling response rate is like 8% or something like that. Like what is the average response rate now?
I think 8% actually might be a little high. There are two sort of saving graces for this. One is that after falling pretty dramatically during the last, you know, couple of decades, it's kind of leveled off. We seem to be at a place where it's going to stay where it is. The other news is that it doesn't seem to have had a really huge impact on how biased these surveys are. And what that means is that for the most part, even with these very low response rates, the people who are picking up the phone are still fairly representative of the people who aren't. And there are a couple exceptions to that. You will be shocked to know that the kind of people who answer surveys are more likely to be participating in civic life. If you're asking about volunteering, you're probably going to get a little bit of an issue there. But for most part, more than you would think, it still manages to sort of capture the opinions of people who might not.
So right now, the three most watched races in this country are probably Gillum and DeSantis in Florida, Stacey Abrams, Brian Kemp in Georgia, and Beto O'Rourke, Ted Cruz in Texas. And these are all very close races. Ted Cruz has a bigger advantage in Texas. Yeah. But these Democratic candidates are saying that they are kind of changing the likely voters. They're going to change the electorate. And that is not reflected in the polls. They actually have a bigger advantage than maybe people see right now. Do you buy that argument from these Democrats?
I think it's possible. I think it's not a sure thing. And I mean, one of the things that I've seen pollsters do this cycle, and sort of part of that attempt to talk about uncertainty, is you've seen a lot of people releasing multiple models of what the race could look like depending on turnout and depending on whether you try to measure who's likely to vote in a variety of ways. You know, if you're looking at this election solely from who voted in 2014, you're going to end up probably with a much more Republican electorate than is actually going to turn out. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, here's the thing. If you say, okay, who says, yeah, I'm definitely going to vote, not all of those people are going to vote. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a lot about trying to make an assumption of a group of people that does not yet exist, which is voters who will actually go to the polls. So there's always that potential. And, you know, if you look back at 2017 and some of the special elections in places like Virginia, you did see that models that were based on the assumption that people would turn out who didn't normally turn out did a slightly better job. But it definitely remains to be seen how that's going to play out in these actual races.
I do want to quickly ask about exit polling. Exit polling is one of the weirdest, strangest things that happens on election day. Correct me if I'm wrong. These are people that literally just stand outside polling places and then just do like a quick survey afterwards. And then we all hear about exit polls in the afternoon of election day and read them like gospel. And they always end up being maybe not as helpful as we think. Is that a fair assessment of exit polls?
Somewhat.
Okay.
In the past couple of years and especially this year, there's going to be a few changes. We've been talking a lot about early vote. Mm-hmm. To state the obvious, people who are voting early are not going to be coming out of their polling place on election day. So the way that they get reached honestly ends up looking a lot more like a traditional survey where people are getting called up and trying to account for that. That being said, the advantage that exit polls have over traditional polls is that you can actually weight them to the results that we know have happened. So instead of trying to figure out who's a likely voter, you have the actual results. So once you get down to that, and, you know, obviously they also serve a purpose for networks who are trying to predict, make race calls on the night of. Yeah. For everybody else who's looking at it later, there are some issues with demographics. People have gotten into this a lot about, you know, if you get into things like education and race and exactly how accurate they are. I do think they can be sort of an overall helpful picture of what people were thinking on the day of the election. But yeah, you know, any survey is not going to be gospel. There's always, you know, room for error. It's literally something that gets written up about on every survey.
Right.
There's no room for error. John Kerry became president in 2004.
Followed by Hillary Clinton.
We avoided a massive financial meltdown of epic proportions. The Iraq War ended very quickly. It was all, everything went so smoothly.
God, it's funny. I'm saying these things now to keep in mind for election night, but the amount of weight I put into reporters standing outside of polling places saying turnout seems huge in this one precinct and exit polls say this thing, and then I every time I'm surprised by the result. But yes. I really like, I follow what the report, I mean, turnout's huge. Yeah. Turnout's massive.
Every election feels like you're watching it and somebody's like, oh, turnout's huge in this place. And you're like, oh, great. And it's like, oh, the Democrats up 5 points here. And then John King will go over to this other side of the board and he'll be like, over here, we have 1 million votes coming in for Republicans from this county in Pennsylvania. Yeah. Only 10 people live there, but there's 1 million new votes coming in.
Yeah.
I will say this, my least favorite takeaway from the 2016 elections, the people who go, oh, well, we should have paid more attention to the energy at the rallies, to the, you know, yard signs. It's like, okay, there was like, you know, like a psychic octopus that also predicted the results correctly. That doesn't mean the underlying methodology is what we really want to drill down into.
Hey,
here.
Let's pause for a sec. More on this. I have a lot of questions about the octopus.
Yeah, the psychic octopus works at 538 now. So watch your words, okay?
I think
we actually, this is really rude. He was a guest on our show 3 days ago and was fascinating.
Yeah, psychic octopus told us everything that was going to happen. It was great.
Yeah, he's bullish on Beto.
Yeah. And the psychic octopus said, pay attention to the yard signs and the crowd size.
I have to say, there actually was a psychic octopus, and sadly, it's now a late psychic octopus, which is a collection of words that I really enjoyed saying just now.
Wait, when did the psychic octopus die? That's so sad.
I am Googling this, and apparently in July, but apparently there's another one. So I guess this is the cottage industry.
Was it like his or her like progeny? Is it like a...
I don't know. A lot about this is unclear to me, frankly.
You say you're a polling expert.
Yeah.
And here you are.
Told us you're a polling expert. You introduced to us the psychic octopus. We go through this emotional roller coaster where we get excited about the psychic octopus. Then 30 seconds later, you tell us the psychic octopus is dead. I feel wrenched right now. Like, I don't know how to feel. The country's on the verge of the collapse. The psychic octopus is dead. I feel like
It's fine. Let me tell you more about random digit dialing.
No.
Hope
is lost. The psychic octopus is dead.
I have this image of the psychic octopus in the MSNBC studio just like swinging around the graphics and being like, no, this county with its eight limbs.
I like this idea that we're just sort of going to turn election night into more of like a surrealist nightmare than it is already. It seems like what's needed.
Yeah.
Lean in.
Yeah, people... The screens all go black and it just says bow down before the psychic octopus. Everyone starts.
Okay, here's the thing. Would you honestly be entirely surprised if this were the outcome of the 2018 midterms?
100% no.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if Trump like appointed the psychic octopus to be like in his cabinet or something like that.
Okay, that's my prediction.
That the psychic octopus is going to be in the cabinet?
Wow, those confirmation hearings are going to be insane.
Yeah, the psychic octopus will be able to control the minds of senators. Now also he has like the ability to control minds in my head for some reason.
I guess, I mean, it is like this kind of clairvoyant octopus apparently.
Yeah.
Second prediction, nomination, gonna tank.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, okay. nice pun.
Yeah, oh, well done. Now we legally have to end the podcast. We're required to end the podcast there. Well, this has been great.
This has been great, Ariel. We learned so much about the octopus, also polling and your expertise on the actual issues.
Yeah.
This really was super interesting.
Yeah, and, thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah.
It was really fun. Good luck on election night.
I'm sure you're going to be needed.
Between now and election night, I'm sure there will be 30,000 people who are going to ask you what's going to happen. So Godspeed over the next few days.
Yeah, and when you answer them, you will be making predictions that everyone will hold you accountable for.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Can't wait.
Good luck on Wednesday.
Good luck.
Thank you.
See you.
Ariel, thanks.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.